There's been a lot of criticism of social media platforms lately and the impact they have on our personal well-being and on society at large. Our next guest says a lot of the solutions offered don't get at a basic problem with social media. It's too big. Social media platforms allow us to say as much as we want and consume as much as we want with an unlimited audience. They encourage us to give and receive communication nonstop. And maybe our brains weren't built for that. Maybe we need smaller, slower platforms. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you were monarch of social media for a day, what would you change? Would you try to clean up the place? How would you describe the majority of the connections or relationships you have with people on social media? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Ian Bogost is director of the program in film and media studies at Washington University in St. Louis. He's a contributing writer for The Atlantic. His latest book is called Play Anything, The Pleasure of Limits, The Uses of Boredom, and The Secret of Games. His recent piece in The Atlantic is called People Aren't Meant to Talk This Much. Ian, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much.
Can you start by talking about this concept of mega scale that you lay out in the piece that we encounter on social media?
Yes, technology companies want to be as big as possible. And this is relatively new in human civilization to have companies that service billions of customers all around the globe. And that goal of being as big as possible and reaching as many people as possible has sort of been transferred from these technology companies' business models down to the desires of their users. You want to have as many friends as you can on Facebook or as many followers on Twitter and Instagram as you can get. You want to process all that information by reading your feeds and getting your stuff out there to thousands or even millions of people every day. Not just a very large user base, as my colleague at The Atlantic, Adrian LaFrance, calls it, but an unprecedented one, one that's never been bigger in human history.
Compare that to what psychology tells us about how many relationships we're usually used to managing, close or slightly less close.
It's a lot less. And one of the examples I use in this piece is from a British psychologist named Robin Dunbar, who's famous for this idea of Dunbar's number. And that is 150. Basically, Dunbar's claim was you can have up to, at a maximum, maybe 150 productive bonds with other people. And that's where the human brain starts to shut down. It just can't have meaningful relationships beyond that. But actually, that number, even that 150 number, is big. And most of the conversations, the deep, meaningful connections you have are with a much smaller circle, about, you know, 5 to 15 family members, close friends, and so on. But even if you don't buy Dunbar's specific take, and there are a lot of people who have laid criticism in his feed about that number, I think the idea that there's a conceptual limit, a psychological or even a biological limit to the amount of relationships we can maintain while maintaining those relationships meaningfully and valuably, that does make sense.
All right. Now, if I want to scroll down Facebook or Twitter, I can encounter, consume the communication of, I don't know what, 50 different people in 1 minute. How does our brain that's looking for like 15 closies and 150 further aways or whatever the numbers are, what does that do to us when we're getting this fire hose?
Yeah, well, one thing you might notice if you think about the experience you have on social media is that you tend to be less empathetic or to think less about that there's a person on the other end of that conversation. Instead, it turns into an opponent or an enemy or maybe someone you want to align with. And so we kind of transform those connections with other people into resources that we can use to advance our agendas or to confirm our existing beliefs or to reject or react to beliefs that we don't have. In general, we instrumentalize those people and we take the material and kind of ratchet up conflict around it.
We're talking to Ian Bogost about a piece he wrote in The Atlantic, People Aren't Meant to Talk This Much, about social media, how much we consume, how it may be too much for us, and we'll get to this in a bit, maybe different ways to think about how to design and control our interactions on social media in a healthier way. Join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Have you found yourself scrolling and scrolling on whichever your social media of choice is? Does it all blur together? Does it flatten out your relationships with people. Do you think there's a better way? Is the better way turning it off for you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Before we go to other possible models, Ian, something that really struck me about your piece is, you know, those close people, whatever the number is, 10, 15, 20, we build that over time. And then we might rely on those people more. It really can flatten it out if we just have this flood of people. And you worry that's one of the things that might steer people into, say, a conspiracy theory.
Yeah, one of the things that happens online is everybody kind of looks the same. You know, literally, their profiles look the same as one another. If you bring up someone's Facebook page or their Instagram or Twitter profile, they appear to you the same way that a stranger does. Whereas, you know, when you recognize, you know, a close friend or a family member, all of that sort of meaning that's been built up over many years in that relationship, the reason that you trust those people and that you're willing to take their advice or hear what they have to say and process it based on your past experiences, that takes a long time to establish and you're able to recognize it. But when we have all of these sort of skin deep, constant, small scale interactions with lots of random people and lots of people maybe that you know, but you're not engaging with in that deep, close way that builds further trust, then we're more susceptible to taking their word for things, right? That we treat them as trustworthy interlocutors prematurely.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Elizabeth is with us in Verona. Elizabeth, hi.
Hi, I just wanted to say that I don't use social media to connect with my friends or family more, but to get gardening tips and knitting tips and cross stitch because I don't have anyone life that does it, so it's another way for me to connect to those that enjoy the hobbies I do.
And you restrict your social media use to those interest groups, Elizabeth? That practical stuff?
No, I still have friends and family on my newsfeed for Facebook, but I don't see them. Mm. Like, my whole newsfeed is covered in knitting and cross-stitch and design ideas.
I love it. Elizabeth, thanks a lot for sharing that. And Ian, you talk about some of that in your piece, defining our circles on social media.
Exactly. You know, when you narrow the community that you're interacting with or that can interact with you, one of the things that it does is it allows you to understand and process that information in a more productive way. One way to do that is through common interests. And in fact, you know, communities and message boards around hobbies like knitting, as Elizabeth spoke of, those have been around for a long time online, and they're some of the most productive and healthy communities, or at least they can be, because people know what they're going in for, right? You go there to get knitting advice, and you know, so long as you're a little suspicious maybe of the, I don't know, the political opinions that you hear in your knitting circle, then you're okay, right? And that sense that your circles can be defined, that the software can sort of enforce a smaller community, that's something I'm very interested as a kind of design concept for social media and something that we've seen in the past but sort of abandoned.
Thanks for that call, Elizabeth, at 800-642-1234. Ian, that takes us to a model maybe that didn't survive. Google, was it Plus?
Google Plus, yeah. Google Plus was Google's attempt to make a social network akin to Facebook, which they started designing in the late aughts and rolled out in 2011 or so. And one of the things that some of the designers, including a designer named Paul Adams, who wrote a book about this concept later on, one of the things they looked at was research such as Dunbar's and others that were, you know, looking at the way that sociologists and psychologists establish the kinds of connections we have and what makes them productive. And so on Google Plus, this is a small thing, but a really interesting example of a way of kind of designing this constraint into your online social interactions. They made you, as a user, organize your friends or family into these things they called circles. And that made you kind of go, well, what kind of person is this to me? Is this a family member that I want to share all of my intimate details with? Is this a coworker that I have a different relationship with? Is this one of my knitting friends, you know, that I have yet a different relationship with? And by creating a structure in the service itself that enforced those boundaries, it helped. But over time, you know, we stopped doing that because it didn't produce as much engagement in the software. And of course, Google Plus, the fact that you may not have heard of it before tells you how that story ended.
Talking to Ian Bogost, Program Director in Film and Media Studies at Washington University, author of the book Play Anything. Talk about a piece he wrote in The Atlantic on social media. It may just be too big. We may be interacting with too many people in the same way at the same time. He says we should try some different models. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What is your relationship with social media? Is there a particular thing you do online that you feel like is a good, healthy form of communication? Are there things that struck you as toxic? Maybe you stopped doing them, scrolling through whatever the feed might be. Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Ian Bogost from Washington University, author of the book Play Anything, talking about a piece of his in The Atlantic, exploring what happens to our relationships as humans when we connect with maybe too many other humans on social media platforms. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions for our guest at 800-642-1234. Is there a better way, you think, to use social media? How have you controlled the way you use social media? Or is the best way? No way. 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go back to your calls now. Michelle is with us in Janesville. Michelle, hello.
Hi. So I just want to give a shout out to all of the people who do not use Facebook. Way back in the day when Facebook first came out, and I was very overwhelmed with having to check a personal email and then a work email. And then all my friends were saying, Facebook, Facebook. And I said, oh, I think it's too much for me. I don't think I can manage all of these things. And so I never, ever got a Facebook account. And my husband and I thought we were the last people on earth who were not on Facebook until all of a sudden, all of our couple friends are not on Facebook. So we actually get together for dinners and board game nights, and we have face-to-face groups, not Facebook groups.
I love it, Michelle. And it sounds to me like you feel pretty good about that decision.
I feel great about it. I just hear all the drama and all the other things that people talk about Facebook, and I'm really glad that I never did sign up.
All right, I'm a board game fan, Michelle, so you can invite me over sometime maybe. Ian, that is an option. We can abdicate from the social media system.
It's definitely an option, and you know, as Michelle's story indicates, it's an option that some people don't feel like they're missing out on anything by pursuing. But it's harder than it seems. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, maybe it's not Facebook. You know, Facebook used to be extremely popular with all sorts of communities. Now younger people tend not to use Facebook. They're using Instagram and Snapchat and other services. And there's kind of this, you know, this joke about Facebook having become a social network for boomers, which isn't quite right because they've got billions of users worldwide. But the point I would make here is that it is becoming a luxury to be able to opt out from these systems. They are in large part, or at least in some part, where life happens today. And when you sign out of Facebook or when you close your account, as many people have done in the past number of years, you do miss something. And if you were never there, you might not know that you're missing it. But you know, you stop seeing those stories from your friends or your colleagues. You lose touch with people. And then there's other kinds of services like, you know, like LinkedIn or what have you, where professional life and recruitment and job opportunities can arise. So I think for a lot of people who aren't ready to take the plunge, like Michelle is, they're aware of this kind of palpable feeling that they would be missing out on something without these services. And that's why companies like Facebook have tried to present their services as almost like utilities that everybody needs just to get by in the contemporary world.
Michelle, thanks a lot for sharing your story at 800-642-1234. Ian, you mentioned with Google Plus, which you saw as maybe a healthier model, it declined because of a lack of engagement. Can you talk about the incentive structure that I think pretty much all social media companies have had to boost engagement at all costs?
Yeah, growth all the time, and growth in all manner of ways. Adding more users, getting those users to interact with the service more often, making those interactions more emotionally amped up, because that tends to draw out more additional participation, comments, and reactions. And of course, all of these things are done in order that that engagement can be used as a basis to sell advertising against, which is where Facebook and Google and most of these companies make all their money. So it's mega scale in every way. The total number of users and all of the frequency with which those users are interacting, the amount of material they produce, the acceleration of that material into the hands and fingertips of others. That's where the incentives lie. And you can see why Google Plus, which shut down, was working, you know, a little bit against the grain there. By limiting the way that your posts could get access to other people, that would reduce engagement. So, you know, Facebook took over the mantle of social media right at a time when it decided to amplify as much as it could to as many people as it could, which is, you know, kind of where all the problems started in my mind.
Talking to Ian Bogost about his piece in The Atlantic on social media, the overwhelming mega scale and what it does to our relationships. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Ian, you think we could do a lot better on social media if we have some, I don't know, breaks or limits or things like that. What kind of experiments would you like to see where constraint might make things better?
Yeah, the simple idea is if this mega scale thing is the problem, then downscale has to be the solution. It's just become almost impossible to think about downscaling social media at all because that's not what it is. That's not what it's become, and that's certainly not where the incentives lie for the companies that run them. So if you think about a platform like Twitter, where you can post as much as you want to as many people as you can find, those posts are constrained. They're limited. There's only a certain number of characters in an individual post. And of course, you could write as many as you want in a day. But that idea of a constraint on Twitter, 280 characters worth of text, that's something that we, when we engage with it, we appreciate. We don't feel like, oh, I'm being prohibited from saying what I want. It's like, how can I get the thing I want to say into this small, pithy remark? And what that tells me is that people are ready to embrace constraint. And in fact, that meaning in general comes from it, right? So imagine if those same kinds of constraints applied to the scale issue. Imagine if you just couldn't reach as many people as you could get, but it was limited to, you know, 280 people or 280 posts a day or a week or a year. Or if you could sort of time out a post. You said something and after a while it just kind of dies and vanishes, right? And some of those experiments have taken place across other platforms, but they've always been curiosities. They haven't been central to the way that people experience their use of social media. And I certainly think there's just a lot more thought and design work to be done that might be more healthy.
If my economic model as a social media company is based on working in bulk, the more data I collect from our users by them posting more stuff, the better I do. How do we change the incentive structure for the companies designing these platforms?
It's a huge problem. And in some ways, you might say, well, you can't change that incentive structure. And that's where this question of intervention and regulation maybe comes into play. There's a lot of discussion about what it might mean to break up Facebook or to regulate social media. And I think a lot of those dreams are impossible to realize. Even if you were to break up Facebook, you'd still have several different companies at mega scale, Instagram and WhatsApp, that are serving the same billions of people and encouraging them to do as much posting and as much interaction as they can. It's also difficult to measure and to kind of create equity in these constraints. Like, oh, the algorithm should be more transparent. That's a story we sometimes hear. What does that mean? And who would police it and how would we know? Whereas enforcing some kind of regulation around scale, around the number of people you can reach or the frequency, maybe it's a terrible idea, but it's at least one worth thinking about because we can imagine it downscaling the system and being enforced on these companies.
Do you see room in the market for, I don't know, artisanal boutique social media platforms? I'm just making this up right now.
No, it's a great question.
To reach out to people and, yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
There have been examples of this. Sometimes there are art projects where you can post to this social network 100 times and that's it in your whole life. And, you know, so yes, the problem is as long as megascale exists beside them, it will always win. So, you know, those kinds of artisanal platforms, they become curiosities and, you know, maybe a few people use them. But they don't have the same sort of social and political effect that the 500-pound gorillas do.
Is there something about all these platforms being free, in quotes? You don't pay money for them. You're basically giving your data away. If we paid money for our social media platforms, would we use them in a better way, do you think?
It's a really great point. And you think about how telephones used to work. You know, back when you had to pay for long distance calls, you kind of thought long and hard, do I need to call grandma this week? Or, you know, you made a call because you needed to, and you justified it in relation to the cost you were spending. And the internet made everything free, and therefore we could do as much of it as we wanted. And we've always treated that as a net positive, and it is in many ways. But it also created this other problem where, because there's no cost to communication, we maybe do too much of it.
As we wrap up, Ian, do you have thoughts for individual users? It's going to take a lot to change the social media landscape. What do you think about as a social media user to make the experience not terrible?
Yeah. I mean, I think the first thing is to recognize that this isn't your fault. That this idea that you have to take on the personal responsibility to intervene in your time management or in your life, I mean, that's just sort of rubbish. You can't do it. I mean, you could maybe try to opt out, but if you're participating, you are being led down the path that these companies want. So instead, see how you can tune the services that you use in the way that that Elizabeth mentioned. You know, I'm only going to use it to talk to these people. I'm going to be deliberate about reducing my friends or only talking to this community on this channel. That's one way that you can start to gain a little bit of control over the system. I think what you'll find in so doing is that those kinds of constraints are pleasurable. You don't lose anything, and in fact, you gain quite a bit from enforcing them.
Ian, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Ian Bogost is a program director in film and media studies at Washington University in St. Louis. Talked to him today about a recent piece he wrote for The Atlantic looking at reining in the mega scale of social media connections.